Alvin Toffler, perhaps the world's most famous futurologist, wrote a book back in 1980, and he described a way that we ought to look at human history. He suggests that humanity has endured three sweeping cultural tidal waves that brought tsunami-like change. Wave number one, he said, began when somebody stuck a seed in the dirt and grew stuff, effectively launching the agricultural wave and forcing nomadic wanderers and hunter-gatherers to give way to leathery-skinned pioneers who would eke out a living by planting, herding, and harvesting. That's when we also began to cluster into villages, with most families, including grandparents, aunts and uncles, cousins and second cousins twice removed, all living within stone's throw of each other, often in the same house with each other. Wave number two was the industrial wave. It began in the 18th century, but really took a head of steam, so to speak, after the Civil War, as people began transitioning from farming in rural environments to working in factories in the big cities. They exchanged, as Toffler put it, milking stools for lunch pails, and from tilling soil to turning screws. And that's when families started scattering, and terms like upwardly mobile professionals and nuclear families became words in our vocabulary. It's also when the family structure started shrinking, so that the family norm ultimately was mom and dad and 2.3 kids trying to manage life in a strange new culture, basically all alone. But now, Toffler says, and remember he wrote this 40 years ago, we're transitioning into a third change, the information wave, because machines no longer muscle what moves us. Today's fuel is technology, a technology-infused tsunami that has ramped to such a warp speed that the illiteracy of the 20th century, it's not someone who cannot read and write. Illiteracy today is someone who either can't or maybe he won't keep learning and then unlearning and then relearning new ways of doing old things. For example, driverless cars, same-day delivery drones, 3D printed about anything, face detection payment methods, biomedical wearables, and on the wave roils. With advancements that are coming at such warp speed, you wonder, can I stay on top of this? But this one thing is clear about the third wave. The implications are both wonderfully empowering, but also potentially devastating. I mean, forget outsourcing. Most companies today are trying to figure out how to get their consumers to be their workforce to get the job done. And that's why most of us now bank online and the teller is going the way of a horseless carriage. We also print our own postage. We manage our own communications. We click list our groceries and are daily inundated with so much information and dizzied by a pace so rapid, the jury is really out as to what's going to fail us first, our ability to manage these digital lives or the economic substructure that sustains it. In the eyes of many, it's no longer whether our system is going to collapse, it's when and which domino will be the first to fall. This information wave is so all-consuming, not one aspect of culture is unaffected. It's not just our roads that are endangered by distracted drivers who are texting. Anybody noticed how few families can muddle through even one lousy meal without a fork in one hand and a cell in the other? Dude, dad's checking email, mom's dinking on Facebook, Junior's watching YouTube, Sally's posting a karaoke, much to the delight of some pervert up in Sedona. But hang on now, I just got a Google alert, y'all. Guess what President Trump did now? People are circuits are jammed with warning signals buzzing all around us. Trouble is, nobody knows how to stop this charging rhino. So what do? Well, here's what we've been doing. We've been holding on for dear life, hoping against hope that somehow my family will escape all of these horrors. Toffler, with amazing prescience, writes, "A powerful wave is surging, creating a new, often bizarre environment in which to work, play, marry, and raise kids. In this bewildering context, value systems splinter while the lifeboats of family and church are hurled madly about. The third wave makes a quantum leap from what we have known, from the familiar waters of yesterday to the uncharted course of tomorrow." Well, that was encouraging, Wyatt. Good stuff. Thanks a lot. Here's why I shared that. Did you know that 5,000 years ago, another futurologist, his name was Moses, also wrote a book? A book filled with both warnings and comfort to another group of people facing their own third wave of change. I'm talking about the Israelites. And their first wave of change was when they were spending 400 years in slavery in Egypt. They were forced to make and then haul bricks and then build these huge monuments to Pharaoh's even bigger ego as they lived in little paper shanties in an urban ghetto. Talk about a hard life. But at least they had food, a place to sleep, and an extended family to lean on. But then God raised up an 80-year-old deliverer type who ended all of that slavery. And with God's help, Moses led these people out of Egypt and into the promised land. However, they just couldn't make themselves believe that God would actually care for them there. So they wandered instead for 40 years living like homeless people. And yet even then, this wilderness wave, it did have its moments because they lived every day, they did, protected by the cloud, by food, by water that was squeezed out of a rock. A wandering time, absolutely. But at least they wandered and they were protected by God and they were together. Now, wave number three was the promised land. Because the whole point behind God freeing Israel from slavery was that he was going to give them their own land. And sure enough, the walls of Jericho fell, and Israel conquered all of Canaan and began residing, as the Bible put it, in houses they had never built. They drank from wells they had never dug, and they ate from vineyards they had never planted. And when this mighty caravan entered in, first thing they did was this huge entity of people split into 12 tribes. Tribes that scattered in every direction in search of a new life, better life, in this land Moses said was flowing with milk and honey. Except there was also much about this new land that wasn't so promising. For one thing, it was an evil land inhabited by an even more evil people, because those Canaanites were perverts. Archaeological digs trace the roots of modern pornography to Canaan. And although God promised Israel success on the battlefield, it wasn't nearly as clear whether she would also overcome all of that evil, especially as it began seeping into their homes. And so Moses, kind of like a doting grandpa, stood on the ragged edge of this new wave, and he warned them, "Don't get sucked into the system. Because if you do, one day you could become as evil as the Canaanites." And that's why just before Moses died, he repeated the law he had received so many years before up on Sinai. By the way, that's what Deuteronomy means. Deutero, second, namas, law. And that's what Moses did. He reiterated and repeated God's law. And here it is. "These are the commands, decrees, and laws the Lord directed me to teach you, to observe in the land you're crossing the Jordan to possess, so that you, your children, and their children may fear the Lord your God as long as you live by keeping all his decrees and commands that I give you so that you may enjoy long life. Talk about loving God. He didn't give the law so he could control people. He did it to give them long, joyous lives. In fact, Moses says later that God wanted them not just to survive, he wanted them to prosper. So, hear Israel and be careful to obey so that it may go well with you and that you may increase greatly in a land flowing with milk and honey, just as the Lord promised. Canaan was a rich and verdant land, but they had wasted 40 years just out wandering in the wilderness. An entire generation died doing more than dodging sagebrush. For four long decades, they didn't live under the cover of God's presence, his voice, and his direction. They were in barrenness. But no more, because now life's going to get better. The pressures are going to ease. And we're moving on up to a new land called Canaan. Some of you don't even know what that is. That's all right. We'll keep moving on. But along with this newfound prosperity, Moses realized how easy it would be to forget where they'd come from. And since he wasn't going to be around to remind them from now on, he said, it's going to be up to mom and dad and grandpa and grandma to do what he had previously done. I want you to note that the responsibility, Moses said, for the spiritual training of a rising generation was now passing from national leadership to family leadership. And so Moses pleads, "Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one." In other words, listen up, Grandpa. Listen up, Mom and Dad. Because as you enter this new third wave, you and you alone are now charged with the task of giving your kids truth. The only truth that will empower them to safely navigate the rapids of a frightening new wave of change. And what's the most important truth? You got to teach them that the Lord your God is the one true God. You got that, Israel? You listening, Mom and Dad? It is now your job to cut through the nonsense of a bizarre third wave and protect your kids from the carnality and the compromise of Canaan. And you must do that by pointing them to the only God who is the one true God. So, you doing that? In our third wave of change, are you actively teaching your kids, your grandkids, that God and God alone is the voice of authority for how they must live? And that his is the only voice qualified to speak into the choices that they're going to have to make? Mom and Dad, if your kids are ever going to survive this third wave, you got to do that. It's not an option. It's mandatory. Thankfully, Moses gives us four benchmarks to help us know how we're doing in that regard. Remarkably relevant principles, whether you're an ancient family just settling into Canaan or a 21st century family riding the rapids of a kind of schizophrenic, really brain-damaged America. Now, Moses' first principle is foundational, meaning if you don't get this one, your family is in deep weeds. Love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your strength. These commandments are to be on your hearts. Now, remember, he's talking to parents. So the issue of first importance to every parent as you guide your child through these dangerous rapids is that you, and yeah, he's talking to you, love the Lord your God with a wholehearted passion. Now, just so you don't miss this, Moses said, love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all these commandments are to be on, say that again, your heart. In other words, if you want your kids to successfully ride out this wave, you got to first love God in your own right. With how much of you? All. Mom and Dad, if your kids have any hope of surviving this current whacked out culture with any kind of spiritual connection at all, you got to have a no holds barred relationship with God yourself. He's got to be real for you first. Otherwise, your kids are never going to get there. I've said it so many times, a strong spiritual connection cannot happen through you unless it has first happened to you. Otherwise, how can you teach your son how to have a controlled tongue if yours is always spitting anger, criticism, abuse, and obscenities? And how can you ever transfer the importance of compassion if you never show compassion? If you never give yourself in service to others, even if it is serving in VBS? How can you teach your daughter that she doesn't need drugs or alcohol to solve her problems if you're constantly self-medicating to solve your problems? And how can you teach your kids to depend on God if you never do that yourself? If you never say, kids, we need to pray for one life because we believe God wants us to give over and above right now, and mommy and daddy want to, we just don't know how. See, it's not what you tell your kids that matters. It's what you do. That's what the Munchkins will also do. Family invited some friends over for dinner. They planned a barbecue, but like today, it was kind of hot, so they stayed indoors instead. Now, this was a Christian family, and so before they ate, the host mom asked little Junior, would you say the blessing? Unusually bashful, Junior said, but Mama, I don't know what to say. Oh, honey, just say what you've heard Mama say. And so here was his prayer. Oh, God, why did we invite these people over here on a day like today? And that's what always happens, right? You attend church because you're supposed to, except the kids notice that Dad passes the offering bucket like it's on fire or something. Or you're at Fry's and the cashier mistakenly gives you change for a 20 and you only gave her 10. And you're hustling out feeling lucky and Junior's going. Because what you do, parents, that's what your child will also learn to do. I know that kind of sounds elementary, but my point is your kids are watching you and they are learning from what you do, not from what you say. And Moses said, if your kids are going to survive this third wave, it's going to take more than an apathetic, kind of half-hearted response. Now, your love for God and for His law, it's going to have to absolutely permeate your heart. A 50-year-old study of both Christian and non-Christian families was recently released. Listen to these results. The vast majority of young adults actively following Jesus today either come from non-Christian homes or homes where there was a deep personal relationship with Christ. Very few young adults actively following Christ come from homes where there was a marginal commitment to Christ. Did you hear that? Most young adults who follow Jesus either come from a non-Christian background where maybe they found faith through some dynamic youth ministry such as ours, or they came from homes where their parents were so in love with Jesus, it just kind of oozed from their pores. Not in a weird for Jesus kind of oddball way, just sold out. But very few actively involved young Christians today came from homes where there was a casual, almost indifferent commitment to Christ. That's not my conclusion. That's a 50-year study. One the founder of Young Life agreed to, saying it is easier to win kids to Christ who come from pagan homes than who come from Christian homes. That's sad. chances are better for a kid growing up in a non-Christian home to become a Christian than for a kid having grown up in a Christian home to become a Christian. That's shocking. But not to Moses. He said that same thing 5,000 years ago. Hear me, parents, he said. You got to love the Lord with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your strength. God's commandments are to be saturated deeply within, all-consuming and thoroughly overwhelming your hearts. And if they aren't, if you claim to be religious, but you're not, if there's no visible difference between how you live and how your neighbors live, if there is no forgiveness and nothing but hateful, bitter attitudes plus neuroses, jealousies, angry tirades, and runaway lust, even if you do happen to know all the right church protocol, even if you can quote more scripture than Peter and Paul wrote combined, if you bully and intimidate and bash and discriminate, but then act as though you don't, do as I say, not as I do, we'll never get the job done. I'm not saying you got to be perfect or even within driving distance of perfect. Just saying you got to love God with a wholehearted and sold out passion. Here's a second benchmark. Moses says that parents must also transfer God's truth with diligence. These commandments, he says, are to be on your hearts. That's basic, but you cannot take your kids where you haven't been, right? But once you get there, you got to burn God's truths first in your own heart, but then, do you see it? Impress them on your children. That word impress literally means to sharpen, and it conveys the idea of one object piercing another to make it better. And that's your job, parents. You are to penetrate your kids' hearts with truth that matters for the purpose of making an intentional transfer. Your job isn't complete if all you do is force your kids to conform outwardly to your standards. No, the goal is you must shape your values until your values are his own. You must build within him his own keen, discerning spirit so that your convictions are his. How do you do that? Well, Moses tells us, he says you got to talk about them. And when he says talk, he means get to talk. See, the Hebrews had a word for preach, and it's not this word. They also had a word for making big pronouncements. That ain't the word either. They also had verbs for pontificate, lecture, bark out orders. But none of those words were Moses' words. His word is talk. And parents, unless talk is your primary strategy, you will encounter major roadblocks as you attempt to infuse biblical truth in the hearts of your kids. Because unless you cultivate the discipline of talking with your kids instead of preaching to your kids will fall prey to parenting by the list. And any kid who has been simply handed a list of do's and don'ts, they will never sufficiently be prepared for the third wave. And to me, that is the great tragedy in far too many Christian homes. Far too many kids today are told what they can or cannot do, but rarely are they told why. And though working from a list may work while they are small, it will not work when junior's about to fly the coop. In fact, if all he's been handed is a very long list of your convictions, if the only weapon he's got to do battle with is what you said he had to do, when he's no longer around you, he's going to get clobbered because he will not have the discernment he will need to stand against the enemy's evil schemes. I'm not saying there aren't do's and don'ts, because I believe that anyone who stands for nothing will fall for anything. So every child does desperately need standards by which he can measure his progress. But as your youngster grows older and begins instinctively to question your values, that's when open, unguarded, no topic is off the table, baby, discussions simply must happen, or else your kid is bound to take a tumble. So wise is the parent who learns how to talk with his kids and allows them the freedom to process issues on their own and draw some of their own stupid conclusions. And yes, make some really stupid mistakes. They need to do that while they're still under your cover. They do. You want some suggestions for how you can talk with truth with your kids? First, model before them good decision-making. Have you ever noticed how some people are so decisive they can come to a four-way stop and spend the next 20 minutes not sure? Parent, don't allow yourself the luxury of putting off simple decisions, even one as seemingly unimportant as, where do you want to go to eat? Even that's a teachable moment, because when you sit in the car and do that, I don't care, where do you want to go dance? Let's go to Chinese. Nah, I don't feel like Chinese. Okay, then where? I don't care. Do that drill often enough, and trust me, your kids are taking notes, and maybe one day they will be just as unable to make even the simplest decision. Number two, when your kids are facing a moral quandary, don't just give them the right answer and then send them back out on the streets. And don't make them sit at your feet and listen as you belch out the details of that mind-numbing life lesson you learned while playing putt-putt back in the seventh grade. Instead, play the what-if game. See, the goal is make your kids think. Guide them to evaluate potential consequences of a decision made by imagining the potential outcomes. For example, baby, if you choose option one, what do you think is going to happen? How about option two? And can you think of any other options? That's teaching discernment. And discernment is vital when it comes to spiritual development. And since passion for the Lord is the goal of great parenting, you got to get started now. It's never too early to start teaching your child how to process decisions. Just understand, because I said so, that's not discernment. Neither is, because I'm bigger than you. Or, because you live in my house and I pay the bills. Or, because as long as you're living under my roof, you'll do as I say. When you get big enough to get your own roof, you can make your own rules. Till then, you're going to do as I say, exactly as I say. Got it? That approach may work when your kid is, I don't know, 2 feet shorter and 100 pounds lighter. But kids grow up fast. And before long, your heavy-handed control will no longer bring about the response you want. But even with the little guys, even appearances can be deceiving. Old preacher story. Billy's teacher said, Billy, sit down. Billy kept standing. Billy, sit down. Still, Billy stood. Finally, she walked over and sat Billy down. He stayed down, but mumbled under his breath, I may be sitting down on the outside, but on the inside, I'm standing up. My point is, God has reasons for why his truth is what it is. But when you and I can't, or worse, won't, give logical explanations to our kids as to why, and when we don't take the time to talk with them and help them draw their own wise conclusions, our kids are going to clam up on us and maybe harbor resentments and hostilities against us until their frustration finally mushrooms into wholesale rebellion. Cannot wait to get out of this dump. I'm going to do whatever I want to do. You'll see. I'm going to do everything you said I can't. parents, there's great value in learning how to talk with your kids. No, it's not the only strategy. No, it won't work in every situation. Yes, God gave you a mind, so make sure you use it and discern every situation and then wisely choose the direction and discipline you believe is right. It's just, well, here's what I've learned. You can stomp your feet, pound your fists, and raise your voice and shout all kinds of biblically accurate information. You can pridefully pontificate with prodigious pomposity, pridefully postulating your predilection regarding personal purity. Precisely. And though you may happen to be right, if that's your primary approach, your kids won't be any more impressed with you than you were just now with me. And all you've really done is waste your breath, and in the process, you've ticked them off. Because when your child has never been given the opportunity to explore the why behind your instruction, he will, I guarantee it, rebel. In fact, my ministry tells me the kids who have the toughest time putting it together as adults are kids who constantly had lists shoved in their faces. Because mom had a rule for everything. Tough rules. Strict, rigid, never-bending rules. Even though the truth is, mom's rules were never transferred with discernment. And as a result, Junior faced all kinds of problems in his life. Are there exceptions? Yes. But not many. Okay, Moses, how do these talks take place? When you sit at home and when you walk along the road, when you lie down and when you get up, tie them as symbols on your hands and bind them on your foreheads. Write them on the door frames of your houses and on your gates. In other words, the spiritual instruction of your kids should flow naturally in the normal ebb and flow of home life. You don't force it. You just let it flow. You don't segmentize it, save it all up for Sunday. You let it flow when you're washing dishes, doing chores. My personal favorite was bedtime. Just talk. No heavy-duty sermons, no angry tirades. You just let it flow. Maybe you're watching TV and something offensive happens. Don't ignore it. Don't pray they didn't hear it. Seize the moment. Hit pause and say, baby, we don't do it that way, do we? Do you know why? After church, while still in the car, do you ask your kids what they learned today? Do you look at their papers? Do you hang them on the fridge? Do you help her with her memory verse? In your home, I encourage you to use religious plaques and scripture verses in the decor in every room. I remember in particular when I was growing up, this one picture, it wasn't even a good picture, but it had these words on it: choose you this day whom you will serve, but as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. And trust me, in my teen years, there were times Stevie wasn't making good choices. But that verse, at times, came to my rescue to save me a lifetime of regret. And that's what Moses is saying when he says, write them on the door frames, put them on the gates, because the artwork in your home, plaques, portraits, knickknacks, the music you listen to, it not only makes your place beautiful, it can serve as a quiet, non-intrusive way of exposing your kids to eternal truth. You do that, mom and dad, and you'll have fewer reasons to fear Canaan. I didn't say no reasons, just fewer. There will always be struggles. In fact, Moses mentions one. He says, when the Lord brings you into the land he swore to your fathers, to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, to give you, I mean, when God fulfills his promise, gives you this new land, a land with large, flourishing cities you did not build, plus houses filled with all kinds of good things you did not provide, not to mention wells you did not dig, vineyards and olive groves you did not plant. Then, when you eat and are satisfied, be careful that you do not forget the Lord. See that? Be careful. Now, there is nothing wrong with having nice things or enjoying God's favor. And that's really good news, right? Since everybody in this room is in the top, like, gazillionth percent when it comes to prosperity in our world. And Moses says, okay, go ahead, enjoy it. Eat, drink, and be happy, but also be careful. Careful that you don't grow fat in the trough. Careful that you don't get spoiled. Careful that you don't overindulge. Because in the third wave, our kids will increasingly live in homes they didn't pay for and drive cars they didn't have to wait for. And there is grave spiritual danger in that. Our youth leaders tell me that one of their greatest concerns for the kids in our church is that they get whatever they want. They've been everywhere and seen everything. They drive better cars than the youth workers drive. And what concerns me is maybe they could get satisfied. What that means is maybe they will develop a self-esteem that's just, it's coming out the wazoo, even though they've done so very little to earn such a massive self-esteem. Because they haven't actually achieved anything they've got. Kind of like Israel. Moses saw that downside and warned of grave danger should Israel forget that it was God who had made that happen. You see, when the enemy strikes, and he invariably will, your unprepared and satisfied child could get blown right out of the water and forget, as Isaiah put it, that all we have accomplished, Lord, you have done for us. So Moses said, be careful that you do not forget the Lord who brought you out of Egypt, out of the land of slavery. And then he gives three great promises that can help you courageously nurture your child's perspective regarding prosperity. I want you to see these. Fear the Lord your God, serve him only, and take your oaths in his name. Here's promise number one. The fear of God will keep your family from pride. Because Moses says, when you enter this new land and begin enjoying blessings you didn't work for, if you fear the Lord and teach your kids to fear the Lord, they will know that God alone is who exalts a person. So when you fear him, you're protecting your kids from becoming prideful. Here's promise number two. Service to God will equip your family with strength. Moses says, serve him only. I wonder, are you teaching your kids how to serve? Is helping other people a top priority in your home? Do you financially support kingdom projects? When it comes to serving in the church, do you model before them a heart of service, even if it is VBS? Are you sensing a trend? Wow. Is this on? See, it's one thing to tell your kids to serve God, and another entirely to show them how. Promise three. Moses says the name of God will give your family holy power. So take your oaths in his name. Solomon said it. The name of the Lord is a strong tower. The righteous run to it and are safe. In other words, God's name is like a mighty fortress. So run to him when you need safety. And you will find in him all the strength you need to rise above the waves. But don't forget, teach your kids to also run there and to call on him when their faith is being tested and to cry out to him when their moral standards are being tempted. Teach them boldly, verbally, loudly to say, in the name of Jesus, my Savior, my Lord and my God, please, Jesus, come rescue me. Keep me from harm. Another benchmark, and we're done. If you want your child to rise above the waves, fight against forgetfulness. Moses says, be careful that you do not forget the Lord. Meaning, don't ever forget that He's the one who got you here. But then he shifts his focus in verse 20 because his concern really is for the children. And he says, parents, in the future, when you get to this third wave and you claim this new land as your own, or for us, when Junior comes to you someday, and he will, and he asks you, what is the meaning of the stipulations, decrees, and laws the Lord has commanded you? Tell him. Talk with him. Say, Bubba, for 400 years, our people were Pharaoh's slaves, but the Lord brought us out of Egypt with a mighty hand. Before our eyes, He sent signs and wonders, great and terrible on Egypt. But maybe He brought us out from to bring us in. I could preach a whole sermon on that, and someday I think I will. Because if there's any truth that you and I ought to be living in and counting on, it's the truth of that last phrase. That whatever God has brought me out from, He did it to bring me in to something far greater. Are you with me? I mean, I'm telling you truth. If God has brought affliction or suffering or loss or disease or death out of your life or the life of your family, if your story includes financial ruin, the loss of your job, your home, maybe your health, whatever painful circumstance He has chosen for you to endure, God has brought you out from there to bring you in. I don't even know if you're following me. So I want you, in your mind right now, pick the worst thing in your mind that has ever happened to you. Okay? Take a moment. Whatever that is. If you believe that God is the author of your life, even that thing, you can say to Him, God, You did. You brought me out of the greatest tragedy I have ever known in my life. You brought me out from that. And I'm trusting You now, having brought me out from there, to bring me in. You understand, God didn't save you by bringing you out of the depths of your sin to then just up and leave you. He's got an even better place now that He wants to bring you into. He didn't dredge you out of the depths and teach you to swim just up and let you drown. He plans, having brought you out of that painful experience, to bring you into His greatest blessings ever. I am telling you, I have never seen this verse quite like I have been seeing it in the later years of my life. And so I am trusting God. And though for the longest season of my life, it seemed that it was suffering. Even in the church, it felt as though our ministry was on hold, just waiting. But now we're claiming, and the Lord who brought us out from is bringing us in too. And the same thing is true for your family. So keep waiting. If you're in this time of affliction and suffering, the time will come when it's God's time. And He will, because He said He would. He will say, when? It's soup now. We're moving on. You see it? He brought us out from there to bring us in. To give us the land He promised to our ancestors. He commanded us to obey all these decrees and to fear the Lord our God so that we might always prosper and be kept alive, as is the case today. And if we are careful to obey all this law before our God as He has commanded us, that will be our righteousness. I want you to imagine for a moment go back with me to that day with those families then. Those third wave Israeli families huddled, celebrating the Passover. Their official time for remembering. Baby, you see Mama mixing that Carol Chef? That hummus stuff that you don't even like? See, that is a picture of the mortar that the bricks your granddaddy made and then laid back in Egypt. And you hear this flat, crunchy bread. It's also a reminder, baby, of that hasty exit your grandparents made when God's whim for bringing our people out of Egypt finally arrived. And that lamb, see that lamb represents the blood of another lamb that got passed over because the blood of that lamb was painted on the door frame when the death angel made his visit. And baby, God did other things too. He raised up a leader named Moses who parted the sea so we could walk across on dry ground. And God fed us manna because we were hungry. And He made water come out of a rock. He's been so faithful to us, kids. And the God of our forefathers, He's your God too. He really is a strong tower. So whenever you're afraid or feeling troubled or weak, or you think maybe the waves are going to overcome you, remember what God has done before, He still can do. And if He brought you out from, He's going to bring you in too. Parents, I got to ask you this, and then we're done. Do you have stories of faith that you regularly tell your kids? Stories that you use to rehearse with them so that one day when you're dead and gone, and that day is going to come, maybe they can still recite the great and marvelous things that God brought your family out of, but then in too. I'm a storyteller, so my family's got all kinds of stories, like the time we had to sell our barbecue grill just to buy kaopectate. Seriously, it happened. And I'm not going to tell you about it. Or the night I had to give Andrea CPR and we rushed her to the hospital and thought we were going to lose her. Or when we felt God's call to move from Ohio, couldn't sell our home and had two house payments for nearly 7 years. Or when I lost everything I held dear except my children. But what I never did lose was my faith in God. And even now I'm telling stories to my adult children. This past week, I told my middle daughter that I have never regretted following God's call into the ministry, even though I always knew there were way easier ways to make a living than the one God led me into. And I also told her I never regretted giving huge chunks of what I did make back to the kingdom, because I believe and am still trusting that one day He's going to shower His blessings on me. And that even now, I can tell them, and I do, I've never known one day without God's provision, without His loving care. Just saying, I hope you have your stories too, about how the God who brought Israel out of Egypt and then into that new land called Canaan how he's doing that same thing for your family too. Now, it may be true, I've got a slight advantage over you because God has called me to both write and preach, which means one day after I'm long gone, if they want to, and who knows, the jury's out on that, but maybe they'll pull out a CD and listen to Papa tell some of their family stories. Or maybe pick up a book and read something that he wrote. Which means, if they do, and I pray that they do, I'm going to be like Abel, who by faith I still speak even though I'm dead. And if I am still speaking, that means my life is still going to be talking, both to and with my children, imparting to them my faith, my love, and my hope. And all I can truly hope for, or any parent can hope for, is that the words that I speak will, for the most part, square with how I have lived. Are they going to find that I did that in perfection? Absolutely not. But if I'm faithful to do it the best that I can do, maybe when they're called upon to make their choices, and then when my kids' kids have to make their choices, maybe by God's favor, they will choose to walk with Him like me. And that's how you do the job. Parent, you love the Lord with all your heart. You transfer from your heart with all diligence God's truth. You nurture a godly perspective by modeling that very same perspective. And then you tell your family stories so that, having been reminded of God's faithfulness to your family in the past, your kids and their kids will remember to not forget Him in their future. Would you bow with me, please? Today is a day of baptism. We've already celebrated that after first service, and the waters are ready just outside these gray double doors. We'd like to invite you to come. We know of at least one who's planning to follow the Lord in obedience through baptism, and I'm trusting that maybe there are more. I want you to know we're ready. If you believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of the living God, and if you believe that God has raised Him from the dead, if you would just confess Him before men, you would be saved. And the first thing that believers did in the New Testament after being saved was they submitted to the watery grave of baptism, dying to the old man of sin, being buried in water, and then rising to walk in a new life. And that can happen for you. We've got towels. We've got all of the clothing needs that you might have. We just love to come around you and celebrate with you the most marvelous decision of your life. I urge you, make this your moment to say to your children, to your parents, to whoever is watching, that you love the Lord your God with all your heart. Just slip out from wherever you are right now. Go to the lobby and someone is there and they'll help you. And you can prepare, and after the service is over, we can share in this brief service. Right now, we're going to turn to the table of the Lord, another picture that Jesus gave us. A little bit of bread, a little cup of juice, a reminder that it required Jesus' ultimate obedience, the gift of His own life, that we might know eternal salvation. So as we take this meal, Lord, would You discipline our hearts to think of You? Would You give us a story that we can tell our children even as we leave this parking lot today? A story of faith and how it is that You truly have brought us out to bring us in. In the name of the Father, and the Son, and the Holy Spirit, I pray.